As millions battle hunger worldwide, where is God? When your family is suffering, when bad things happen, ever wondered what God's doing? For a much-needed biblical perspective on God's providence, stay with us as John MacArthur looks at the life of Joseph on today's edition of Grace to You Weekend. To paraphrase a thought from the great preacher Charles Spurgeon, the keys of providence are in the hands of Christ. Nothing occurs here without his permit or decree. You know, it's true. Everything is under God's control. So what does that mean for your heartaches, the ones that believers experience? Why would a loving God allow bad things to happen to his people? Ever find yourself asking that question? For a crucial perspective on the providence of God, stay tuned now for Grace to You Weekend. John MacArthur is looking at the life of Joseph and will show you how all parts of his life, his triumphs as well as his trials, fit into God's perfect purposes. Follow along now in the book of Genesis if you're able. And with today's lesson, here's John MacArthur.
If you look at chapter 50 of Genesis and verse 20, Joseph says, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive." You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. That introduces us to a characteristic, an attribute of God, which we often call His providence. That is to say that God works His own ends. No matter what the intention of people, be it good or bad, God will bring about His own ultimate end. And what God means to happen will ultimately happen. God coordinates and organizes all the apparently independent activities and thoughts and ideas and movements of people, pulls them all together, makes them harmonize with one another to effect His ultimate ends. That is revealed to us in many stories in the Bible, none more dramatic than the story of Joseph. God intended that the trials of this one very unlikely hero would be for the good of his family, and then the good of that nation that would come out of his family, and through that nation, the good of the world. Joseph suffered. He suffered repeatedly in his life. But the Bible never tells us that God was punishing him for sin. Joseph did not suffer because God was punishing him for sin, but he did suffer so that God could ultimately save sinners. There had to be a nation, Israel, so that out of that nation could come Messiah, who would be the only Savior the world would ever know. It all starts with a family feud. A family feud. Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, the land of Canaan. As the story unfolds, Joseph is 17 years of age. He's pasturing the flock with his brothers while still a youth. Now, come to chapter 37 with me for a moment. And I want to introduce you to how much his brothers hated him. In verse 3, he is indicated to be the favorite. Verse 4, his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, so they hated him and couldn't speak to him on friendly terms. He has this symbolic favor in this robe, which was given to him to set him apart from everybody else. And the whole scene just continues to escalate because apparently Joseph appeared to his brothers to act as if he was a superior, as if he was some kind of royalty, because verse 2 says, Joseph brought back a bad report about his brothers to their father. Now look, it's bad enough to be the favored son, but to be the guy who snitches just compounds the problem. Even more offensive, he kept having dreams, and his dreams were just outrageous dreams, in which in every dream that he reports here, his brothers are seen bowing down to him. paying homage to him. One day he meets his brothers, chapter 37, verse 6, and he says to them, "Please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect, and behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." Then his brother said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. They wanted him out of the family. And their opportunity for them to take some action happens when they arrive in a place called Dothan, where they're feeding their flocks. Obviously, flocks move around, and they're in Dothan. To make matters worse, apparently Jacob used Joseph as his personal spy to go check on the brothers. So he sends Joseph to Dothan, by the way, 63 miles away. So Joseph goes on a multi-day trek, and we pick up the story in verse 17. They have gone to Dothan, so Joseph went after his brothers, found them at Dothan. And when they saw him from a distance, before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we will say, 'A wild beast devoured him.' Then let us see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben, the oldest, heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, "Let us not take his life." Verse 22, Reuben further said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him." He said that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. He was going to have them throw him in the pit, and when they left, he would come back and rescue him and take him back to his father. So that's all being plotted. That's exactly what they do. Verse 23, when Joseph arrived, he reached his brothers. They stripped him of his robe, his tunic, the varicolored tunic that was on him. They took him, threw him into the pit. The pit was empty, without any water in it. They're just done with him. And while they're having lunch, somebody spots a caravan coming. Verse 26, Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites." You remember Ishmael, right? The son of Hagar, the handmaid of Sarah. "Let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. He's our brother, our own flesh." The brothers listened to him. And some Midianite traders passed by. They pulled up, lifted Joseph out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Apparently, they offered the deal to the Ishmaelites and the Midianites, and they took the highest price. 20 pieces of silver, by the way, was the average price for a male slave. Terrified teenager has been hoisted out of the pit, handed over to a group of North Arabian Ishmaelite traders headed for, of all places, Egypt. Joseph continues to plead with his brothers. You won't find that in Genesis chapter 37, but you find that mentioned later in chapter 42 and verse 21, which says, "Truly we are guilty concerning our brother as they look back, because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we wouldn't listen." So he pleads with them, "Please don't do this to me." He's pleading for his life. They want him gone permanently out of their lives. They've satisfied themselves that they're not going to kill him, they're not going to murder him, they're going to sell him for what they can get. So he descends from being a favored son wearing the regal robe of favoritism to being a kidnapped slave. They have engaged in human trafficking, if you will. And surely you begin to wonder what Joseph must have wondered. How can this happen to me? I'm doing what my father tells me to do. I'm obedient. My father has sent me on this mission. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. And then he must have been asking this question: what do those dreams mean, right? Because my brothers aren't bowing down to me. My brothers have sold me into slavery. He's 17 years old, by the way. He's 17 years old. His whole world is flipped completely on its head, betrayed by his brothers, all the joys of home, the security of his father's love, violently ripped away from him. The Lord doesn't condone this evil, of course not, but God will overrule this evil and accomplish his purpose and bring those dreams of bowing brothers to pass in the future. By the way, Reuben, during the negotiation with the Midianites and the Ishmaelites, apparently had wandered off somewhere, and he didn't return until Joseph was gone. And so Reuben's response is in verse 30. He returns and says, "The boy isn't there. As for me, where am I to go? How am I going to face my father?" He tears his clothes. We've got a problem here. How do we explain what we've just done with our father's favored son? Well, they concoct a very elaborate lie. To make a long story short, they kill a goat, they get all the blood, then they take the robe that belonged to Joseph, and they throw it in the blood to deceive their father as if this is Joseph's blood and he's been killed by a wild animal. Ironically, Jacob had fooled his father Isaac by using a goat skin many years earlier in Genesis chapter 27. They took the blood-stained robe back to Jacob. Jacob slumped into a prolonged depression, mourning the loss of his favored son. The other sons tried to console him, Genesis says, but he would not be consoled. Genesis 42:22 indicates that guilt was eating away at Reuben and probably the other brothers as well, but it was mitigated by the fact that they had gotten rid of this irritating boy, or so they thought. So we go from a family feud, just some points of connection, to a false accusation in chapter 39. Let's go to chapter 39 and pick up the story. Chapter 38 doesn't advance the story. We go to chapter 39 and pick up the story there. Joseph has been taken down into Egypt. When he gets to Egypt, do you remember what happened? Verse 1, he's taken to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, that's a very important position. He is the main guard of the greatest ruler in the ancient world, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. So now he's sold again, and he's sold to Potiphar to be a slave in the house of Potiphar. This, again, is another sad incident in the life of Joseph. Sold once, sold again, but sold into a very prominent house. From itinerant, meandering traders, he finds himself in a wealthy, prosperous home of a man with a very high position who interacts intimately with the royalty of Egypt. He has gone from a caravan, if you will, to a castle, a palace. It doesn't take long for Potiphar to find out that Joseph is a very, very capable man. Verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. He made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. It came about from that time he made him overseer in his house over all that he owned. The Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him there he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. Joseph was over all of it. It was the providence of God that he ended up in Potiphar's house because his master was an intimate in the court of Pharaoh. It allowed Joseph to meet royalty and to interact with royalty and to become very familiar with the noble customs of Egypt. Such knowledge would later prove critical and essential for the role that God would have him. He is now directly the manager of all of his master's resources, and he's responsible, and he's getting on-the-job management training for a much bigger management experience that he's going to face very soon in his future. And the plot thickens when Potiphar's wife begins to notice Joseph, and she likes what she sees. The end of verse 6, he is handsome in form and appearance. And it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph. She's pretty direct. She says, "Lie with me." And Joseph responds. He refused, said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house." That's the highest level of trust. He has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I. He has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? It's not just Potiphar, it's God. And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, same message, lie with me, he did not listen to her to lie beside her or be with her. She attempts repeatedly to seduce him. He rejects every attempt. He takes the noble ground, asserts the trust of his master of far more value than some dalliance with her. However, on one of those days, when Joseph is alone in the house, according to verse 11, and none of the men of the household was there inside, she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. He just bolted. He was fleeing immorality. And she's standing there holding the garment. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I screamed when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed. He left his garment beside me and fled and went outside." So she left his garment beside her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with these words, "The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came in to me to make sport of me, and as I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled outside." You know, hell hath no fury like a scorned woman. And you kind of want to say for Joseph, "Give me a break. I can't win in life. What next?" And so far, we don't see him doing anything wrong. And the question has to be rising as his theology is developing, since he doesn't have a Bible to read. He's got to be asking the questions, "God, why is this happening? I was faithful to my father, and I end up being sold into slavery. I'm then sold again. I am completely faithful to my master, and I am lied about. And now, the first time, my brothers took my robe and threw me in a pit, and now this woman takes my robe, and I get thrown in prison." Her fury rages against him, and she hangs his garment in her hand as proof. It was his word against hers. It was going to be Potiphar's slave going to prison and not Potiphar's wife. So Joseph is bound again and becomes a captive in prison. And he must have wondered, "Why are all these bad things happening to me? In the face of obedience to my father, I end up in a pit. In the face of honoring my master, I end up in prison." As far as we know from the text, he hadn't done anything. This cannot be construed as divine punishment. He is endeavoring to honor the Lord by honoring his father, honor the Lord by honoring his master. He's doing what is right. His circumstances seem completely unfair. But God, by the evil deeds of others, which God does not condone, has Joseph exactly where he wants him. The Lord is perfectly in control. The Lord doesn't do evil. The Lord doesn't condone evil. The Lord isn't in the evil, but the Lord uses the evil.
You've been listening to John MacArthur here on Grace to You Weekend. He's the president of the Master's College and Seminary, both in the Los Angeles area. His focus today? It's one of the Bible's most unlikely heroes, the amazing story of Joseph. Well, it's obvious that God used Joseph in some remarkable ways, but frankly, John, the story is so remarkable, our listeners may wonder exactly what they can take away from it. Kind of hard to see how Joseph's amazing life can apply to our less-than-amazing circumstances that we face every day. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, God is no less powerful, no less able to use providence, and that's what the story of Joseph is really about. It's not about miracles. It's not about supernatural powers. It's not about doing heroic Samson-like exploits.
It's about life in the normal course and how God takes the pluses and the minuses, the good decisions and the horrible decisions, and orchestrates his own ends and his own purposes for his glory and the blessing of his people. That's the story of Joseph. And the same God is ordering the circumstances of the life of his children and also orchestrating the circumstances of the life of those he is bringing into his kingdom. Now, this is the way to look at life. We don't need fantasy heroes in the movies. We don't need to trivialize heroism or mythologize heroism. In fact, real heroes in the kingdom of God are being made evident all the time. In fact, throughout the history of the church, God has used the not many noble, the not many mighty, the lowly, the nothings, the nobodies by the world standards. But he has used those people with their strengths and weaknesses by orchestrating in a sovereign and supernatural way all of the infinite components of their lives to collect together and bring about his purpose. God himself is the hero behind all the heroes in Scripture. God is the true hero, and he still operates heroically in my life and your life. The book on unlikely heroes includes 12 biographies that you will thoroughly enjoy, affordably priced from Grace to You, the book 12 Unlikely Heroes and free shipping in the U.S.
How does God use ordinary people? How can he use you to accomplish his purposes? Find out in John MacArthur's new book, 12 Unlikely Heroes. Pick up your copy from Grace to You. It's affordably priced. By the way, this book brings to life characters including John the Baptist, Joseph, Esther, Enoch, and Jonah, riveting stories of life-changing truth. To order 12 Unlikely Heroes, call the toll-free number 1-800-55-GRACE. Or go to our website, gty.org. The price for this hardcover book is reasonable, and remember, shipping is always free. Again, call 1-800-55-GRACE, or to order online, go to gty.org. By the way, at gty.org, you can also download any of John's sermons, 3,000 total available. They are free in the MP3 or transcript format. Our website also has an ever-expanding blog on topics important to all Christians. Find us on the internet and come back as often as you like, gty.org. By the way, if you're benefiting from the website or this broadcast, please let us know. Send your email to letters@gty.org, or using the regular mail, write to Grace to You Weekend at Post Office Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412. And thanks for remembering that we're listener-supported. Write to Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412, or call 800-55-GRACE. And now for John MacArthur, I'm your host, Carl Miller. Thank you for joining us today. Remember, you can see Grace to You Television Sundays on DirecTV, Channel 378, or watch online at gty.org. Then join us right here next week for another half hour of Unleashing God's Truth, one verse at a time, on Grace to You Weekend.